Yeah, so I'm just going to do a quick summary or recap of Nico's paper, and then I will raise a few questions to get us started before turning it back over to Nico for a quick response, and then we'll have hopefully quite a bit of time for Q&A at the end. So this is a highly original paper. Just want to thank Nico for offering it. I think it's a great one to start us off. It's a novel problem for those who would be skeptical theists. So in the past, other people have tried to show that a skeptical theist, for example, can't consistently maintain confidence in everyday moral knowledge or knowledge about the character of God. But Nico's suggestion is that she'll actually have difficulty maintaining intuitively reasonable assessments of the probability of future states of affairs in general. So the trouble is, a theist would like to be able to say that while regularities in the world justify her making many inductive generalizations and predictions, it rains about 9 out of 10 times when the weatherman says there's a 90% chance, bullets fired at innocent victims at close range predictably cause severe pain to those victims. There are some circumstances in which it would be reasonable to alter one's straightforward inductive assessment of the probability of some future state of affairs obtaining, because of the moral magnitude of the situation. So a theist wants to be able to downgrade the probability of an atrocious moral horror, to use one of Nico's examples from the paper, say the destruction of some hypothetical island, Atlantis, on which there are a very large number of morally exemplary beings who would die, because she thinks, surely, God wouldn't allow something like that. So she'd like to be able to identify future states of affairs that would be, quoting from the paper, so negative as to override God's powerful reasons for permitting antecedently predictable events, and to take the horror of such evils into account in assessing the probability that God would permit or actualize them. But the skeptical theist, Nico thinks, can't do this. So he has in mind a skeptical theist who, roughly following Bergman, denies that anything we know about the justification-relevant properties of future states of affairs could constitute more than negligible evidence about the overall justification God's permitting or actualizing those states of affairs would have. You can refer to the skeptical thesis on your handout, which is Nico's generalization of some recent formulations, for example, in Bergman. So the skeptical theist thinks that we're going to have problems identifying any special problematic future states of affairs whose probability ought to be altered in light of moral considerations. And maybe she thinks we have a further problem. Even if we could identify those states of affairs, maybe we wouldn't know how to adjust our assessments of those probabilities. Nico gives the skeptical theist two options. First, she could take the seemingly extremely unattractive way of screening off. On this horn, the skeptical theist simply gives up trying to meaningfully predict the future at all. So we have no ability to assess the justification-relevant properties of states of affairs. Thus, we can't know how likely God is to actualize or permit them. For any state of affairs we imagine, it's raining tomorrow, the elimination of Atlantis, we cannot meaningfully assess the probability of that state obtaining. So Nico describes the skeptical theist on this horn as just assigning a probability to any state of affairs S obtaining at a time T in the future by partitioning the space of epistemically possible outcomes at T and then assigning S an equivalent probability to every other state of affairs in that partition. But this is crazy. The weatherman says it's 90% likely to rain, but who knows the mind of God or the goods and reasons in play? Best to be 50-50. The real problem is, if she tries to do this, and if her credence in theism itself is less than one, then the repeated occurrence of events that were quite predictable on the negation of theism will bombard her with a stream of evidence disconfirming theism. So if we set our minds at the ready to just be continuously open to whatever God might throw at us, we'll be obliged to conclude after some interval of time that we had been much better off admitting the world is more or less predictable. On the other hand, the theist might try the initially seemingly more attractive way of imitation, where she continues to assign probabilities to future states of affairs, but gives up trying to adjust for God's moral or modal reasons. So all theists, Nico assumes, are committed to the thought that whatever actually occurs, God is justified in allowing to occur. So over time, even skeptical theists acquire a string of experience of the states of affairs that God is justified in allowing to occur. She may note that the allowed states of affairs in general seem to coincide with those states of affairs that were predictable on the evidence excluding God's moral reasons. The skeptical theist can then justify assigning to any possible future state of affairs, S, whatever probability S would have conditional on the negation of theism, or the probability of S on our evidence excluding any evidence about God's moral and modal reasons. So Nico identifies two problematic consequences for taking this horn. First, what he calls extraordinary and wholly unexplained coincidence. So this skeptical theist, as a theist, is committed to thinking that the conditional probability of God's being justified in permitting S on the actual occurrence of S is one. Moreover, on this horn, she's committed to thinking that the probability of S is just a function of factors that exclude God's moral reasons. So the meteorological facts that might ground an extremely high probability of Atlantis's destruction in a hurricane or something force her to conclude that it's extremely likely that God will be justified in allowing or inflicting Atlantis's destruction. But why in the world should meteorological facts matter to our assessment of the justificatory status of God's allowing such an event? Second, and relatedly, the problem of screening off. So not only does this meteorological evidence seem irrelevant, it might seem to screen off other seemingly relevant evidence about God's justificatory status. So we want to be able to say that there is some number, arbitrarily high number of healthy inhabitants Atlantis might have, such that God would likely not be justified in allowing Atlantis to be wiped out. But for the skeptical theist on this horn, again quoting from the paper, there is no amount of objective intrinsic value such that learning that the natural disaster will lead to its loss will cause our skeptical theist to reconsider her belief that God would be justified in permitting it. Nico briefly considers whether the skeptical theist might try for some kind of middle way between these two horns, but he thinks that any deviation from the way of imitation will be poorly motivated for one truly committed to the skeptical thesis, that the properties of states of affairs relevant to the question whether God would be justified in permitting those to occur constitutes negligible evidence about the overall justification-conferring status of those properties. So she certainly cannot just appeal to our moral intuitions. However, as Nico notes at the end, none of this need be a problem for theism in general. He describes a non-skeptical theist who has a theodicy, explaining that God has powerful reasons for permitting many of the events antecedently predictable on the way of imitation, but also who also maintains a robust view of her capacities to assess moral and modal facts, including her ability to detect exceptional circumstances that are so negative as to override those powerful reasons. Right. So that's just a summary of the paper, and I'm going to raise just a few questions to get us started. First, thinking about the way of imitation in this first problematic consequence of extraordinary coincidence. This looks to me to be largely chargeable also to many non-skeptical theists. So Nico assumes that for all theists, S's occurring implies that God is justified in permitting or actualizing S. The problematic consequence for skeptical theism is supposed to be that so-called physical evidence raising the probability for S looks as though it should be irrelevant to questions of God's justification. But consider the seemingly very ordinary scenario I've sketched on your handout in notation from the paper. Basically, whenever a state of affairs is antecedently less probable, just considering facts about what God has reason to actualize, then it seems given physical evidence. And a theist doesn't want to say that this is a case in which she should deviate from the way of imitation, she will have to admit that so-called physical evidence can raise the probability of God's being justified in permitting it. So imagine you're a theist who's just not very sure whether or not God would be justified in allowing, X billion chickens to die by the end of the year. So despite not endorsing the skeptical theist, you just don't have a theodicy that decisively weighs in on whether he would or wouldn't be. You don't think that you ought to deviate from the way of imitation on this occasion. But there are still 3 weeks of 2014 left, and suppose I tell you that we're 99% of the way to that number. Now it looks like you too, despite not being a skeptical theist, are getting weird, seemingly amoral evidence that God is in fact highly likely to be justified in allowing this number of chickens to die. So there's some more general set of conditions on theism that's wider than the skeptical theist that seems to actually get problematic consequence number one going. It's something like, you know, not having a view of God's sovereignty on which he's justified in doing just anything at all, but also not decisively ruling out all possible states of affairs he might not be justified in permitting. So this doesn't necessarily do anything to deflect the problem for skeptical theism in particular. I just want to highlight that this may actually be a broader challenge for many theists to make sense of the coincidence of predictive physical evidence and God's likely justification. So next question, I'm wondering how non-skeptical a theist needs to be in order to be able to make predictions of future states of affairs in an attractive way. So the non-skeptical theist Nico describes at the close of the paper, who has a very robust view of her moral and modal intuitions, and a theodicy that allows her to identify when and how to depart from the way of imitation, seems to clearly achieve this desideratum. But you know, Nico doesn't claim, and it doesn't seem obvious, that this is the kind of position we're forced to if we want to have a satisfactory way of predicting the future. And we might actually worry about this sort of strong theodical position for other reasons, in particular some of the reasons that seem to motivate skeptical theism in the first place. So we might be somewhat drawn to the idea that an appreciation of the need for epistemic humility in light of our limited cognitive situation, vis-a-vis God's reasons and possible goods beyond our ken, calls for some kind of domain-specific distinctive humility when it comes to assessing God's justification in permitting various states of affairs. Perhaps a moderately skeptical theist, while not endorsing the skeptical thesis as stated, would still want to say something like, you know, we ought never to be too sure that any particular state of affairs justifies a departure from the way of imitation. Or alternatively, we might think that something like skeptical theism has a distinctive contribution to make, not in the way we predict future states of affairs at all, but in some special kind of updating procedure on whatever predictions we do make. So she might say that we're free to make predictions about states of affairs based on assessment of God's moral and modal reasons for permitting those, but whenever events occur in actuality that we would not have thought justified, we must accept that God was justified in allowing those to occur as a kind of revelation or something without losing confidence in theism. So it seems an interesting question whether more moderate or alternative forms of what we think of as skeptical theism could also allow us to predict the future satisfactorily. Finally, though, I want to think about just how bad it would really be for a properly skeptical theist to just grasp the second horn and take the way of imitation. After all, skeptical theists have perhaps already been willing to bite some pretty nasty bullets, admitting limitations on our moral knowledge and our knowledge of God's character. If they took the way of imitation, we'd have to accept that the probability of events occurring is, in general, evidence for God's being justified in allowing them to occur. But as I've said, it seems to me that many theists will have to swallow this. They would also have to accept this idea that there's, you know, no amount of objective intrinsic value such that learning that a natural disaster would lead to its loss should cause us to reconsider our beliefs that God would be justified in permitting it. But it's not clear to me that this is so great a cost. Remember that skeptical theists are theists, and they may still maintain that there are at least a few states of affairs that God won't bring about, which we can maybe even know by divine revelation. Maybe the extermination of the human race would fall into this category. And moreover, they may count it a virtue of their position, that it doesn't tempt us to rule out horrific states of affairs as unjustified for God to permit. The problem of evil gets going in the first place because of states of affairs like the Holocaust. Who would have considered in advance the possibility of the Holocaust and thought, sure, God could be justified in allowing that? As it happens, we find ourselves in a world of horrors, and a willingness to think God may be justified in allowing horrors may be a precondition on belief in God. So those are my starting questions, and I will turn it to Nico. Thanks.
All right, I want to thank Laura, first of all, for the comments. They are great, and the summary of the paper is pretty much perfect. Couldn't have asked for a better summary of the paper. And I want to thank everyone for inviting me. This paper is actually based on my master's thesis that I wrote here, so it's nice to be back and giving it to you. Okay, so I wanted to respond basically point by point to the questions that Laura raised about the paper. So the first question is about whether this problematic consequence about the unexplained coincidence between the kind of moral and modal properties that are relevant to God's justification in permitting a state of affairs and like these natural properties that we use in physical science is confined to the skeptical theist, or whether that kind of problem extends to other theists. I think that's a really interesting question. I think maybe the best way to think about it is that there's this continuum of possible views you can take towards our epistemic position concerning the moral and modal realms. And as a theist, there is this commitment to some kind of connection between the moral and modal properties of states of affairs and God's justification for permitting them. And so as soon as we move away from a really robust view of our capacity to identify the kinds of events that God would be justified in permitting, we lose our ability to explain the connection between natural properties and the moral properties that justify God in permitting events, and then we start having to make inferences from properties that seem intuitively irrelevant to moral matters, to moral conclusions about the events that instantiate those properties, like the destruction of Atlantis. So it's an interesting question. We can talk about more what versions of theism are susceptible to this concern, whether there are any plausible versions of theism that are not susceptible to this concern. One version of theism that's not susceptible to this concern is a version of theism according to which you just believe that you know everything about value, and so have an explanation for why God would be permitted in allowing the destruction of Atlantis, no matter how many people live there. But you know, you might think that if any version of theism is true, it's not that version of theism. So that's an interesting question, and we can talk about it more in discussion. So the second thing that Laura talked about was this proposed middle way. And I want to particularly talk about the suggestion that we adopt a new updating procedure, which allows us to kind of take the occurrence of an event as a revelation that God was justified in permitting it. I'm a little bit skeptical about this. It seems kind of ad hoc to me, and I think a way to see that is to imagine that we applied an analogous updating procedure to some other proposition. So just suppose that we were geocentrists, and we decided that we would update by conditionalization unless we observed something that would directly disconfirm geocentrism, and then we would not update by conditionalization. To me, that seems like a kind of unfair thing to do, in the sense that it ends rational discussion about geocentrism. it's hard for me to see that like this other kind of updating procedure when applied to theism would be any different. So somebody who wanted to advocate that as an approach would need to tell a story about why this kind of special updating procedure is not relevantly similar to the case I just described, why it's like well-motivated for theism, whereas it wouldn't necessarily be well-motivated for other kinds of beliefs. And, you know, maybe there is a story to be told, but I'm a little bit skeptical. And then last I want to talk about biting the bullet. I'm actually, you know, quite happy if the theist bites the bullet. It's a dilemma, so something has to happen, and, you know, great, take the second horn. I wanted to talk about the suggestion, though, that it might count as a virtue of the skeptical theist's position that it doesn't tempt us to rule out horrific states of affairs as unjustified for God to permit. So I'm not exactly sure what's going on here. So it's true that if you exist today and know about history and are a theist, you're committed to thinking that God was justified in permitting the Holocaust. It doesn't seem to follow to me that the Holocaust is not deeply problematic for theism. So again, I think it's relevant to consider any other thesis. Suppose I'm a geocentrist. You present me with evidence for heliocentrism, and I say, but surely, as a geocentrist, I must not have responded to that evidence by not being a geocentrist. To me, that seems like not relevant to the question of whether geocentrism is rational or whether the evidence requires me not to be a geocentrist. So I think it's not sufficient to note that if someone is currently a theist, someone must have responded to this evidence in the past in a way that didn't cause them to give up their theism. I think there has to be a story about why that was an appropriate response to learning about the Holocaust, and that story has to take into account the kind of substantive argument that the atheologian has given that events like the Holocaust count as evidence against theism. So I think in order to make this response, you have to kind of presuppose a cogent response to the evidential problem of evil. So dialectically, I'm not sure that it works here to make this response to the atheologian, if that makes sense. So those were my comments. I'd be very interested to hear what everyone has to say.
Can you just expand a bit on the middle way and why negligible doubt isn't enough to get you sort of like that? There's a certain number of people in Atlanta that just has to be really, really high.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
I was just trying to understand your response to the middle way, which in the paper I didn't fully follow it, but I just kind of blew it past me. Can you say how that goes?
Oh, okay. So you're not talking about what Laura was saying. You're asking about the paper itself. Yeah.
Well, was there a difference between the, has it changed since?
Well, she offered ways that the skeptical theist might try to rehabilitate the middle way.
Right.
And I had a criticism in the paper. So.
The one in the paper.
Okay, so the one in the paper, the thought was just, look, if you think that your moral and modal intuitions provide negligible evidence concerning the justification relevant properties of states of affairs, then you shouldn't, your intuitions aren't going to kind of be able to support a robust deviation from the way of imitation, right? So we have these two horns. Ideally, you would want to kind of selectively choose between the way of screening off and the way of imitation. But the point is, if you believe that the evidence is negligible, it's going to be hard to get away from the way of imitation. If you obviously there's a continuum here, you could say that the evidence is of any strength. But to the extent that you think that the evidence is stronger, you're going to get the conclusion that actually, you know, prima facie horrors are actually horrors, right? So deviating is actually not going to be that helpful, because you're going to deviate towards prima facie judgments about horrors. So you know, you could adopt a number of positions. The negligible evidence position does seem like one in which you're not really justified in deviating very much. A more robust view of our knowledge of moral properties is going to kind of reconstruct the problem for the theist, because the problem is that we have intuitive judgments about states of affairs that are actual, to the effect that they're bad. So really, it just seems like, even though there's a continuum of views to me, there's nowhere on the continuum is going to be like a satisfying place for the skeptical theist. Does that make sense?
This out there. In the end, I don't think that this is really a sort of viable position for the skeptical theist, but I mean, you might press on in the first horn of the dilemma, you might press on the use of kind of the principle of indifference as a way of characterizing, cashing out what you're, if you have sort of no evidence about what a particular event that sort of evidential import of that for there being a God, because you have no sort of really no idea what other good making features there might be, and you can't. You might think that the right way to respond to that, I mean, the right way to sort of model your ignorance about the evidential imports of various future events is using something like imprecise credences instead of using the principle of indifference. So instead of, maybe instead of just using the flat distribution over all future events, I use the set of all distributions of that partition. And, you know, this is going to allow me to the issue is, or one issue anyways, is, this seems like a position available to the skeptical agnostic, but not the skeptical theist. I mean, it's going to allow me to be non-crazy about lots of other my normal reasoning about the world, and I mean, basically, the picture ends up being one in which, look, I have no idea what any of the stuff that I'm seeing means about this other thing, whether it's there being a God or some other event. Or some other proposition, and so as I go through my life as a good epistemic agent gathering evidence, I continue to get this evidence. I have no idea what it means for this other proposition that I care about, and the effect is just that I continue going on having no idea whether that proposition is true or not. So I'm not determinately gathering disconfirming evidence. So it's allowing me to continue to have imprecise credences about whether there's a God or not. I guess sort of pushing toward a question, do you think maybe there's some sort of middle ground here in between the principle of indifference and fully imprecise credences that allows you to characterize, model your views about your failure to have determinate views about the evidential import of various future events for there being God, that seems more palatable, that would sort of allow you to, if you got enough intuitively disconfirming evidence, eventually your credences will become less precise. So I'm final sentence. I wonder to what extent it's an artifact of you using the fact that you're so quickly getting really strongly disconfirming evidence. I wonder to what extent it's an artifact of you sticking to a precise framework and using principle of indifference rather than going some kind of intermediate view between flat distribution and fully imprecise and somewhere in there.
Yeah, so great question. So actually, Laura had prepared a little bit of stuff on this question and then chose not to talk about it. So why don't I talk about the idea of mushiness and then also the idea of staying within a precise framework but giving up the principle of indifference. And then if she wants to, Laura can talk about her idea, which was to introduce a new kind of doxastic attitude of suspension or inscrutability that the conditional probabilities of various outcomes on theism would be assigned. And I can talk about my thoughts about that. So first of all, actually, when I was first thinking about this issue, I was interested in like imprecise or mushy credences and their relation. I think a question is, suppose that we assign each of the elements of this partition of possible future states of affairs, conditional on theism, some mushy credence, like maybe the maximally mushy credence. And then one of them is going to occur because it's a partition. What happens to the credence in theism, right? I think probably it goes mushy, if it wasn't mushy before. And then when it goes mushy, you know, it looks like if it's really mushy, the person is no longer properly characterized as a theist. And so that seems bad to me. Which is why I like stopped trying to do mushy credences. Now, then moving back to the precise framework, so you could give up the principle of indifference. I mean, the thing is that the only set of credences that's going to work to avoid this problem is one that matches the credences on the negation of theism, or approximates it, right? And like to the extent that it approximates it, this problem is going to be avoided. Even if you're just really permissive about the kinds of credence functions that are rational, it would be another kind of remarkable coincidence for the theist always to choose the credence function arbitrarily that matches the credence function conditional on the negation of theism, right? So suppose that, you know, we had a similarity ordering on future states of affairs and like, you know, the skeptical theist just picked one and thought that was the most probable and then kind of like distributed probability like around the ones that were similar to that, right? That won't work either. Because that's not going to be like the distribution on the negation of theism. So it looks like there's only this very specific way to escape the problem with precise credences. And even if you're very permissive about what kinds of credence functions are acceptable, the theist can't just say anything is rational, but I always pick this one. Or at least if he does, there needs to be some story. And then so then there's this other way of going, which is to like introduce a new epistemic attitude, doxastic attitude, that Laura was thinking of.
Yeah, I had first written this to Nico, but then decided it was so unpalatable a choice that well, I started thinking that maybe, you know, if you really took home the skeptical thesis, you would start even to doubt the relevance of your epistemic possibility state to epistemic possibility space to, you know, God's, the actual range of options available to God to actualize. So, you know, maybe what you really have to do if you take the skeptical thesis home is just abstain, you know, from making any predictions about the world at all. It's not that you're 50, you just don't, you have no idea. You make no predictions about what's about to happen. And if you don't, it's not as clear to me that you can have such a theory disconfirmed if you're not making predictions at all. But this is no way to be a cognitive agent. So I guess it's a, you know, it's a question whether ultimately somebody who accepts the skeptical thesis is bound to do something like that, some kind of more radical abstention from partitioning, you know, even using the principle of indifference. But yeah, I was just thinking that, well, there's something good about that. It's not as clear that you would get disconfirming evidence immediately. It's just that you'd be probably psychologically impossible and not very epistemically attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had a few comments about this kind of strategy too. Well, there are two options, which I don't know how distinct they are. One is to say that the agent has no doxastic attitude towards the relevant conditional probabilities. And the other one is to say that there's this new attitude, inscrutability, or suspension, which we add to the reals between 0 and 1 as a possible like attitude towards a proposition or conditional proposition. And I was thinking more about the latter option. My thought was, you know, this is fine. You know, there's no law against it, but there needs to be a story about how this new attitude is going to fit into the Bayesian framework. And as far as I know, there isn't really a story. So in particular, like now that we have this new attitude, how do we recover the law of total probability? What happens to expected utility, decision theory? You know, if you have this attitude towards all of the members of the partition and then one of them happens, does theism get assigned that attitude? Or does theism just, I mean, what happens when you update on some new evidence where your conditional probability in that evidence occurring was this new attitude on theism? So there needs to be a story about conditionalization. There needs to be a story about all of these different parts of the Bayesian framework that incorporate this new attitude, and I'm not sure how it's going to go. And then the other comment that I had was, it's not clear to me that if a theory makes no predictions, it becomes immune to disconfirmation. So if you can imagine that like our epistemic possibilities are partitioned into two theories, one of which makes no predictions, the other of which does, it seems like there's some amount of evidence that's consistent with the predictions of one of the theories such that we would respond with judgment to somebody who continued to believe in the other theory, the theory that makes no predictions. On the other hand, it's hard even to imagine that there could be a theory which excludes another theory that makes predictions and itself doesn't make predictions. Because it seems like if a theory excludes a theory that makes predictions, it must predict that the things that are predicted by that theory don't happen as often as that theory predicts, at least, or something. So there's a question of whether it even makes sense to say that there can be rival theories, one of which makes no predictions. But if there can be, then I still don't see why the theory that makes no predictions would thereby become immune to disconfirmation. So I think that there are a number of like kind of problems with that approach. So three approaches, none of which I think are particularly attractive. So that's why I kind of want to stay within the precise framework.
Roger had a follow-up.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I follow right. The worry about commissivism, so it sounds like there's something fishy about the theist who says, just so happens that I have signed conditional probabilities that match the atheist, so we make the same predictions or something, even though it's permissible for me to have other ones. And then you're saying, it can't just be that, there has to be another story or something. And you think, if permissivism is correct, then, well, it's permissible for the theist to have those probabilities. It was the worry that even assuming permissivism is correct, there's something wrong with the theist just
something problematic about theists just happening to have credences that give them the same predictions as the atheist, or is that more really saying there's got to be something wrong with permissivism if that just allows you that kind of easy way out or something?
Well, I think the thought was it's not just happening that the theist has those credences. What's happening is the theist is looking at the possibility of having his theism disconfirmed and then choosing a credence function that won't let that happen. Right. So this, the argument in the paper is run from the perspective of one agent's credence functions, right? So I don't know, it would just be surprising to me if permissivism is true for like the vast majority of theists or something to like arbitrarily, not looking at downstream consequences, choose exactly the right credence function.
Yeah, I'm imagining they say, no, I am looking ahead. I'm trying to protect my belief from disconfirmation. So I'm going to pick these ones.
Okay.
Because that's what I want. You say, is there anything wrong with that? Say, well, no, because they're permissive.
Okay, yeah, so I mean, I don't have anything great to say. So rational but underhanded is what I would say.
just a little thing. I mean, it's worth noticing permissivism doesn't sit very well with the rhetoric of skeptical theists, if that's the sort of the main topic. Because, you know, if you're a permissivist, it looks like it's also permissible to, you know, treat evil as evidence against God. So, you know, it's not very skeptical theist friendly, but it's I know that it's still worth looking at as a view in its own right.
I don't think that's a good view.
Maybe just a question about the suspension of judgment inscrutability move. Maybe I missed it and you had considered this, but you might think of it not as the sort of thing where you assign some non-real numbered value to a given proposition, and that being the sort of suspension attitude, but something more like your algebra being such that that proposition like doesn't appear in it. And then I would think that you wouldn't have any problems with like the law of total probability. I mean, you'd have to have some further explanation of, you know, how you might come to have a probability assigned, or, you know, how your algebra might change and you come to assign a probability to that thing.
That's right, yeah.
But you might need a story like that independently if you think, if you don't have this view that basically you could be like a priori omniscient, and so you think you can come to gain new concepts and thereby entertain new possibilities, so your algebra changes in that respect.
Yeah, so this is what I was thinking about when I said that there was this option where you say the person doesn't assign any doxastic attitude at all to the questions, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a little bit weird because the partition is a partition over possible futures. Contingent on theism, which the skeptical theist invests a substantial portion of her credence in, right? So it would be strange to think that this person has no doxastic attitudes towards the possible futures conditional on the thing that she believes. I mean, it's possible. You'd have to tell a story about how this person plans and reasons. And then it also, you know, it would be a framework in which it would be hard to make predictions about what this person would end up believing when something did happen, because then something would become evidence for this person which was not previously in their algebra. Mm-hmm. And I don't know.
Yeah.
There could be a story according to which there could be arbitrary changes in like the person's total beliefs.
Although that's kind of a problem anyway for the view that you can come to entertain new possibilities in virtue of
that's yeah, that's right. That's true.
Where there's this kind of black box aspect.
Yeah.
I just want to understand one thing. I know it's a bit wacky, but could you try and protect yourself not by suspending on things conditional on theism, but being a theist that suspends on everything conditional on atheism? Where that that just goes, as it were, there's nothing in your algebra, you know, atheism is like this point one black box, but it doesn't get subdivided, that doesn't get subdivided, that's like, you know, dark side.
So yeah.
All the structure is on the theist side. It feels that might be a... That seems to work a bit better anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, you know, the problem is generated by the comparison between the predictions of theism and atheism, and like, you know, obviously, you know, there's symmetry. You can either have no predictions on one side or no predictions on the other side. So I think it's possible that that would work. It would kind of make nonsense of methodological naturalism in science, though. You know, like, you know, you think, well, what you do when you're a physicist is you think, well, what if it's just these particles and they have these properties? Can we make predictions? And then, you know, if you're a theist and you want to become a physicist, you have to say, God, I just have no idea how to do this. I don't know. I mean, it's a very interesting suggestion. Thank you.
And there are all those radical orthodox theologians that are saying methodological naturalism is completely misguided and, you know, can't even entertain it. So, I don't know. I do think there are some people coming this as a characterization. So far.
Follow up from John.
Maybe I misunderstood your proposal, John, but I mean, this proposal isn't necessarily making
that?
If the atheism side is black box and the theism side.
So I mean, the 0.9 theism, 0.1 atheism, but the atheist nugget doesn't get subdivided.
It makes my predictions about ordinary events.
Yeah.
And the theism side makes indifferent predictions.
All sorts of structured predictions are there. Okay. Yeah, so the idea is on the theist side, there's all this nice structure. On the atheist side, there's just, you know, like a black hole sort of thing. Yeah. Then it seemed like things had worked already. Yeah.
So what kinds of predictions is the theist side going to make? I mean...
Some of what you're worried about will come back, because they'll be alarmingly similar to the ones that the atheists physicists will make.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Billy?
Just a question about the setup. I don't know what comes of this, if anything. So, when you set up skeptical theism on page 2, you've got Bergman's claims about us having no good reason for thinking the possible good we know of are representative of the possible goods there are, etc., etc. And then you say at the bottom, the skeptical thesis is the more fundamental concept that's underlying these. Bergman claims, but the skeptical thesis is a claim about what we would be able to know conditional on God's existing, right? It says, if God exists, what would we be justified? What would we be justified in permitting? Whereas there's nothing in the Bergman claims about our cognitive faculties. If God exists, the Bergman claims are just, I mean, as they're written, I don't know what Bergman himself says, but as they're written, these claims are just about what we can know. These are just generally skeptical claims about what we can know about what goods, the relationship between possible goods and the goods that are, you know, So if anything, I was just thinking that looks like the skeptical thesis is actually a more limited claim and not a more fundamental one.
So what the skeptical thesis says is that what we can come to know or justifiably believe about the properties of states of affairs, which states of affairs, those relevant to the question of whether God, if he exists, would be justified in permitting blah, 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 right? So it's not a claim about what we cognitively do if God exists. It's a claim about what we cognitively do, whether or not God exists, with respect to the properties that are relevant to the question of whether if God exists, such and such. So those are logically distinct. And the point to be made here is that Bergman chose ST1 to 3 because he thought that they were realms that are relevant to the question of whether if God exists,
okay,
he'd be justified in
permitting, fine,
blah, blah, blah.
Just the thing is that it's a little bit helping you if focusing, so the skeptical thesis is still more limited in that it's a claim about the relationship just between God's justification and bringing about states of affairs and not more general justification, or whether we have more general justification about, sorry. I'm just wondering if it's helping you a little bit that you're focusing on just skepticism about what God would bring about, whereas if you're focusing on, if we were holding fixed skepticism about all kinds of good-making features, whether God's in the picture or not, the skepticism might, I haven't worked this out, but I'm wondering if the skepticism would also impact what things are going to go like conditional and not theism.
So we have this kind of moving part in the debate, which is, under what circumstances is God justified in permitting some state of affairs? Plausibly, that depends not only on the intrinsic goodness or badness of the state of affairs, but also on modal relationships that that state of affairs enters into with other states of affairs. But as long as you acknowledge both of those parts of the story about what justifies God in permitting things, then all value properties and all modal properties are properties relevant to the question of whether God, if he exists, would be justified in permitting the states of affairs to occur. So my thought about the skeptical thesis is that it does imply skepticism about our access to all value questions, all value judgments, and all modal judgments. And not just value judgments or modal judgments if God exists, because all of those judgments, all of those properties of states of affairs are relevant to the question of whether God, if he exists, would be justified in permitting them. So, I mean, to me, there's a relationship not exactly of entailment, but at least of strong support between the skeptical thesis and SD 1 to 3. It would be very strange to endorse the skeptical thesis and reject SD 1 to 3. So I'm not sure.
If I was certain God didn't exist.
Then if you accepted the analysis of what makes God justified in doing something, you would still have to say that the moral and modal properties of states of affairs are relevant to the question of whether God would be justified in permitting things if he did exist, right? His like contingent lack of existence doesn't prevent those things from being relevant to like the question of what he would be allowed to do if he did exist, and so you would have to take the same epistemic view towards those domains. It's my thought.
Yeah, I'll follow there. I'm not sure.
You had a
question? Yeah, it's not gonna fully formed, but I think I just wanted to say a bit more about the problem for sort of middle way positions that go very far towards the sort of way of imitation view, where I'm just like, yes, like, look, I get extremely negligible evidence. You know, so if I've already got like a pretty high credence in a benevolent deity, I also have like extreme moral ignorance, I think. So if I look at past events, I find it very hard to say whether they were net good or net bad. I think that's actually mostly to be determined. You know, because I don't know about all of the causal impacts of those events. So actually, like, I'm massively morally ignorant anyway. It just doesn't seem very implausible to me to say that if I do have a high credence in a benevolent deity, then I'm just going to, like, look at these events and say, yes, I'm, like, it just gives me extremely negligible evidence with respect to whether God's, about whether God was justified in permitting it or not. And I kind of wasn't seeing why that was supposed to be so counterintuitive.
So can you say more about why that's a middle way and not just the way of imitation?
So it was extremely close to the way of, so the thing that I see as being definitely counterintuitive is that I could receive no such evidence. So I'm like, yep, I buy that. If I go to hell and everyone's also in hell, then I'm like, yes, I now have really good evidence that, like, you know, maybe that's the thing that tips me. But anything up till that, I'm just like, no, it's sufficiently negligible that the evidence has to be extremely strong. So nothing that we've ever seen before, and certainly nothing that I kind of expect to see in the future. So it's not quite way of imitation, because it is saying, yes, there is some possible evidence. And I see, you know, so I'm like, yeah, look, if you say there's no possible evidence, I find that counterintuitive. But I don't find the position that's extremely close to that, which just says, yes, there's possible evidence, but it's, you know, it's extremely, extremely, extremely rare.
Yeah, so I mean, to the extent that you approximate the way of imitation, you're also going to approximate the bad consequences of the way of imitation, right? So one of the bad consequences was, look, your beliefs about what God would be permitted in doing, conditional on some like factual knowledge about the stratosphere or tectonic plates or something, are just like super resistant to change in light of new information about value. So you could learn that like so many people were going to die in Atlantis, and it wouldn't change your prediction that God would be justified in permitting it, right? So to the extent that you approximate the way of imitation, you're going to approximate that problem. It won't be true any longer that for any number, you're going to say, well, it doesn't really change my belief, but you know, for like very large numbers. And you might think, you know, moving from any number to like very large numbers is not a smashing success. If you acknowledge that this is a real cost to the view, then it should be a real cost to the view, even if it's like mitigated in this kind of small way.
Yeah, the thing I'm seeing is why that's a real cost to the view rather than just something like a description of the view. Like, I'm just like, yeah, that seems like what they should.
Well, you know, every cost is a description. If you bite the bullet.
That's a description of the view in question, though. Like, I mean, yeah, maybe that's it. I just thought in advance that the view would say something like this, and then I was like, oh yeah, that's not surprising. That seems kind of right if you put that view.
Did you follow up still, or?
Yeah,
Margaret. Yeah, I think this, I was worried about something before. I still don't quite get the answer. So it seems like the view says, the horrors we've seen so far give me negligible evidence. If you multiply them by, you know, you multiply that, you know, 1,000 by 1,000 times, then I'd come to doubt. So if there were a horror that were 1,000 times worse than anything we've seen so far, that would do it for me. And you're saying, sorry, I guess I've lost track of the response. You're saying 1,000 times is too high a threshold? So 1,000, so if Atlantis contains 1,000 times the moral exemplars that died in the Holocaust, and that's what it takes for me to give up theism. You're saying that's too high. I should give it up somewhere below there.
I mean, yeah, I do think that.
Well, I mean, I think the Holocaust is enough. If I don't, if I sort of get in the mindset of someone who thinks the Holocaust wasn't enough to do it, then I guess I'm on the side of, I'm sorry, I don't mean thinking this is just a description of the view.
Yeah, so I wasn't thinking I wasn't thinking that this person was reasoning about events like the Holocaust. I was thinking that this person was looking at like fundamental physics or something, and was saying, look, descriptions of the, like, this kind of science has given us great predictions, so it must be the case that whenever physical properties are disposed in this way, they are later disposed in this way, and so God must be in general justified in permitting this kind of transition on the level of physics. You know, to me, it does seem like a bad consequence if you have to get to, you know, events 1,000 times as bad as the Holocaust for someone to start revising their beliefs that God would just obviously be justified in permitting them on the basis of some physical evidence. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's kind of it's a point that's sensitive to your, you know, intuitions about what it's okay to believe as a theist. If again, I don't think it's great to say, look, because the Holocaust happened, and I'm still a theist, the Holocaust didn't provide convincing evidence that theism is false. So I wasn't trying to attribute that kind of strategy to this person. I wasn't trying to say that this was a person who said, horrors have already happened, therefore God must be justified in permitting future horrors. That was kind of the strategy that I was criticizing at the end of Laura's comments. So I guess I'm not really sure what to say, because it seems like you're thinking of these two strategies as the same. You're thinking that the person who adopts the way of imitation is adopting this strategy, because you said this is a person who looked at the Holocaust and thought that it wasn't evidence. Right. Well, yeah.
Whether or not to cause a bit of death, but it would take 1,000 times more to get me all the way. So, a low credence.
I mean, yeah. I think also that the skeptical theist doesn't want to say that, because there have been so many horrors. So it'd have to be less than 1,000,
right,
or more than 1,000. Yeah, but
so
yeah, but yeah. So I wasn't thinking of these two responses as the being the same. I'm not really sure what to say about that. I mean, if you're comfortable with having this resistance to disconfirmation based on value judgments, then I guess that the horn won't be that compelling.
Follow up, and then wouldn't the right way to make this theist a more rational is just to say that they're going to have reasons for thinking the theist is true, and it's going to depend on what those reasons are. So if you have some kind of argument which, for the existence of God, or evidence for the existence of God, which is so strong, or perhaps so insensitive, these different kinds of evidence, that you need 1,000 articles before
Yeah, so I actually don't think that that is the right way to think about it, right? So the question of the problem of evil is not really, well, it doesn't have to be a question about what the status of theism is on our total evidence. Right, so saying, like, you know, possibly the theist has total evidence such that after updating on evil, the theism survives. Yeah, that's, you know, true, but the question is, or it might be true, but the question is whether evil constitutes, like, a serious source of disconfirmation for theism, and that can happen even if there's overwhelming evidence for theism. So I kind of don't want to go down that road. So, like, you know, it seems obviously true that there are possible sets of evidence such that, you know, no matter how bad evil is, if you had those sets of evidence, you would be fine in being a theist, you know, if you had constant, you know, revelations. I think the dialectical situation in the debate over the evidential argument is one where we're not considering that kind of situation. We're asking, you know, what's the relevant ratio of the conditional of the probability of theism after updating on evil, and the probability of theism before updating on evil, and that can be, you know, there could be a manifold decrease without an absolute decrease being very large. And that'll happen in particular if you have really convincing evidence for theism.
So thinking about what happens over time, though, is you, if you do have, you know, a total evidential situation, take yourself to a total evidential situation in which, you know, you're very convinced of theism, and, you know, you learn about history over time. It seems like, as you know, instead of like Jonathan was saying, getting little bits of disconfirmation from each of the horrors that you learn about or consider that are going to build up. Actually, if you take each of these on board while having in the background a very high confidence in theism, what you're learning is something like, you know, this God that I believe in tolerates that, and he tolerates that, and he tolerates. So if over time what you're doing is not, you know, discounting your credence in theism by bits, you're sort of expanding your elastic capacity to take on God's allowing horrors. I mean, if that's the way you're thinking of it, then it's sort of, if we've already gotten as far as the Holocaust, is there really going to be anything that's going to come along that we're not going to be willing to take on board? So it seems like the background confidence in theism that allows you to withstand all the stuff we've seen so far actually is going to do some work in making it, you know, not so crazy to think that, you know, we'll just be able to take on what happens in the future.
So I actually think that these are two different kinds of responses. So one response is, look, you know, whatever, evil lowers the probability of theism, and, you know, the ratio, you know, reduces the probability of theism by a factor of 10 to the 6th or something. And you could say, well, but, you know, I have evidence that increases the probability of theism by a factor of 10 to the 12th, so whatever, I'm a theist. That's one response, and that's a response on which you don't say things like, when I learned that the Holocaust happened, I learned that God is the kind of God for whom it's okay for the Holocaust to happen, or yeah. Something. You say, oh yeah, that disconfirmed theism, but luckily it got confirmed a lot later. The other response is this kind of like response that's suggested by Laura Buchak, where you, like, instead of updating by conditionalization, you do this other thing where you say, look, you know, I assign a certain amount of my credence to theism, here's this thing that was unexpected on theism, so instead of reducing my credence in theism, I'm just going to, like, repartition the inside of my theism credence. So maybe now all of my theism worlds are worlds in which God is justified in permitting the Holocaust, but there are just as many theism worlds as before. Mm-hmm. And I think actually that's kind of like differently motivated than the kind of response I was thinking about. Potentially much stronger, because if you have that response, then even if you didn't have overwhelming evidence for theism, you could respond to things like horrors without losing your credence in theism.
This is what I was thinking of, and I was thinking that something, you know, it's some kind of argument for theism, a reason for believing in theism, that would get you to the place of thinking, well, my credence in theism is just 0.9 or whatever, and that's not shifting, right? That's what would hold that, you know, general credence in theism stable as you repartitioned. So it just seemed like, you know, they are two separate responses, but the, you know, whatever reason you take yourself to have for believing in theism in general is still doing a lot of work in the second response, and that could be used there.
Yes, so my understanding of Laura's stuff is that the choice between conditionalization and this other kind of updating is not made on the basis of the strength of your evidence for the view, but on the basis of other factors like, I'm not exactly sure. There are lots of, I think there's a lot of different options, but certain evidential relationships between the hypotheses, or like if it's a theoretical hypothesis of science or something. But I mean, you could say that there is a kind of evidential status that a belief can attain that then demands the non-conditionalization kind of updating. And you could say that that's the kind of evidence that theists have for theism. And then you could make this move. I think that's an interesting question.
Roger, so I think some people do say something like this, that it's about entrenchment or something, that certain probabilities are entrenched and they're more stable and you keep them fixed.
Yeah, but is it about the evidence that we have for them, or is there a different explanation of the entrenchment?
I'm not sure I even understand it. I don't think it's just about the strength of the evidence.
That's what I was saying, yeah. it's something else. There's some other factor that like causes some beliefs to be such that when you learn about evidence that bears on them, you have to do this thing instead of conditionalizing. And you know, that's a big part of the theory, that you can just choose what to slot into. But it's an interesting suggestion.
Okay. New.
Yeah, and it's interesting, kind of impinges on what you just brought up, kind of. So many people become less and less skeptical as they get older and older. So I'm wondering if your theory, if you can take into consideration modeling future expected changes in attitudes, or not changes along the way. So at each time that someone is thinking like of the future, they're actually modeling in how they will change in the future according to how conservative they are with their view to skepticism. So they become less and less conservative as they get older. Is there any way that you can maybe put that in your theory or model it somewhere?
So I'm not sure that I'm super understanding the case. So when you say skepticism, what kind of skepticism do you mean?
Okay, so let's say someone is 0.8 theist and 0.2 skeptical, or atheist.
Mm-hmm.
As they get older, that percentage goes up for the theist views. And the person knows ahead that in advance that they're going to become less and less skeptical as they grow older. So I know you're talking about partitions at this moment in time, in terms of how someone's projecting their current views on how they're going to be for the future. And this isn't even on updating. This is on, and it's sort of similar to Lara Buchak's version, except that it has to do with taking into consideration a person's dynamic change of how they actually view the evidence as time goes by. So they'll take the same evidence, but they'll view it in a different fashion. So I'm wondering if you can think of any way of incorporating this kind of picture into your model.
So I think that the rational response to like learning that in the future you will interpret your evidence differently depends on whether you think that you'll interpret it better. In particular, whether you think that your future self is an expert to which you should defer. I mean, if you don't, then it seems like, you know, you don't want to make decisions, you don't want to just contentedly plan to have your credences move away from your current credences because you think they're moving away from an accurate assessment of your evidence and towards an inaccurate assessment. On the other hand, if you think that your future self is going to have better judgments about your evidence, and you know what your future self is going to believe, then you should defer to your future self, at least plausibly. So, you know, the way to incorporate that kind of case into like a Bayesian framework is going to depend on like a more fleshed out description of the case, right? So look, I mean, if I know that somebody's going to compel me to take a pill, and the pill is just going to scramble my credences so that they have no relation to my current credences, and I have no reason to believe that they're going to be closer to the truth, then you know, I should think of that as a really bad thing, and I shouldn't defer to my future credences. On the other hand, if like somebody's going to give me a pill that makes me omniscient, and then all of my credences will be one or zero, one in just the true propositions. And I know which ones are going to be one and zero, then I should defer to my post-pill self. So I think it really depends on, you know, whether it's a good change or a bad change.
Yeah, that's why I thought it wouldn't be able to be incorporated. But there are different ways of thinking about it versus getting closer and closer to being accurate. Or better and better. But anyway, I could talk to you more about this afterwards.
John? Just a little thing on the way of imitation. It seems to me like a bad feature of it as it's set up, not that you, I mean, I know you don't like it, is that it prevents things that are intuitively good news for theism being good news. I mean, I'd have thought even skeptical theists sort of agree on reflection that if suddenly one day all the good people start disappearing, just all the obvious people there, you know, that's, I mean, it just seems a bit bizarre to think that that outcome is as likely on theism as atheism. But, or, you know, the clouds over Nazareth start spelling out.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, that's not unique to the wave of imitation, right? So the wave of screening off has that too, right? If you if you have a principle of indifference over future outcomes, then you know,
So, for different reasons, so all of these strategies, as it were, like seem like non-starters for that reason too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's
that are good news for theism being good news for theism.
I think that's right. I mean, this is a general fact about skeptical theism, right? You know, in order to buy resistance to disconfirmation, the skeptical theist has to give up the resources to say that certain things that are good news are really good news, and that's the cost. Luckily, you know, they say we have the ontological argument. Etc. But yeah, I think that's right.
Quick follow up on that. This is just clarification. You are thinking that the way of imitation can incorporate a theist sort of putting in special exceptions for divine revelation, right?
So yeah, that's right. So if the Bible says, like, look, here's really good evidence for theism, whatever. It's going to rain fire and brimstone for 100 years, and then the Antichrist is going to come, and then after that there will be 1,000 years, blah, 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 I don't know. Then you could say, look, I saw this thing happen. I don't know on the basis of exercising my moral and motive faculties alone whether it's good, but I read in a book that this is going to happen if theism is true. So it must be the case that this is confirmation for theism. Yeah, so... to the extent that you have access to predictions that theism makes, not on the basis of just exercising your moral and modal faculties, you can escape the problem. But it seems implausible that all of the things that we want to call good news for theism are going to be things that we're going to be able to recover from special revelation or something. Yeah.
I think we're about out of time unless there's any final questions. Let's thank Laura and Nico.